Welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright. Richard Russo's new book is a departure for him in that it's nonfiction. He's best known for his novels, most of which have been set in blue-collar, hard-scrabble towns like the one in which he grew up. In his most recent novels, including Everybody's Fool and Trajectory, his characters have begun looking backwards, reflecting on their lives. And in his new book, called The Destiny Thief, Russo does the same in first person. But while the book may be a departure in genre, it shows off the same rich sense of humor and deep appreciation for humanity that typifies Richard Russo's fiction. The Destiny Thief, Essays on Writing, Writers, and Life is published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I am so happy that it brings Richard Russo to the show today. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Kai.
So, why'd you start writing essays?
Actually, a fairly practical reason. Since the Pulitzer, every now and then people will want me to come and give a talk, and they don't want me to read from one of my novels, and so I have to have something to say. And so over the past, some of these essays go back a way, including a talk that I gave at the graduation of Colby College when my daughter Kate graduated there, and she's in her mid 30s now, so that one goes back a ways, yeah. But a lot of these essays were written so that I'd have something to say when people invited me to go somewhere and give a talk and just didn't want me to read from one of my novels. But it also gave me a chance to talk a little bit about something that has been puzzling me in my novels for a very long time, and that is destiny and the shape that lives take, first and foremost, kind of my own, because it's still, my own life is deeply mysterious to me. I'm trying to figure it out.
You and many of us. The title of the book comes from the essay on destiny. You say, you've wrestled with this a lot in your fiction as well. Help us think through this. What this sort of wrestling with the past we choose in life, especially when we're starting young. You talk about it sort of through college, and you say college should be like going into
the witness protection program.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
Well, for most of us, by the time we finish high school, we have we have a kind of record already, of all the things that we have said and done and who our friends are and especially the mistakes we've made. They live in a 17-year-old or 18-year-old's mind, and they grow these into enormous proportions. And usually by the time you're 18, you're ready to start over, clean slate. You want to go someplace where nobody knows you and pretend to be somebody else, and it's almost everybody in every university is kind of doing that same thing. And with me, it was even more so, because you don't have to go very far. You just have to be among strangers in order to invent that new life, that new person. I, on the other hand, after living in a small town in upstate New York, I put some geographical distance between my high school self and my university self. I went 3,000 miles away to the University of Arizona, where I would be sure nobody knew me. And so in addition to wanting to create a new self, there are certain ways that I had to, large and small. I had to learn out west how to wear Levi's, for instance. You have to button. They're number one, it's not a zipper, right?
It's not.
And you have to have someone teach you that you button those buttons from the bottom up. It's the only way it works. And I had to learn all that stuff in order to become a new person.
What were you trying to get away from?
I think it was what everybody's trying to get away from in that old self that you would like to discard like a snakeskin. But there was also I think a lot of history. There was the fact that my grandfather, whom I absolutely adored, my maternal grandfather, who was a glove cutter who worked in the skin mills of upstate New York in the town that I was from. who became very ill as a result of breathing leather dust. He had emphysema from the time that I was a boy. And it got progressively worse. He was also a smoker, so he contributed as well. But by the time I was 17 or 18 years old, he was living in a room with an oxygen tank and basically strangling and with his heart going like a trip hammer. Leaving when I did to go to college in a kind of awful way absolved me from being there at the moment that I was going to lose someone I loved as much as anybody in the world. So there was that, and of course there was the rage that I felt because he didn't deserve that, and my mother was of the opinion that this town that she grew up in and that I grew up in did this to him. And she herself desperately wanted to get out. And the real reason we went all that way to Arizona was that it was not so much that I was getting away as that she was getting away. So there was all of that. So there was all of that kind of multi-layered history.
I'm speaking with Richard Russo, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, about his new book of essays, The Destiny Thief. And, you know, so in that story, Richard, and thinking about destiny, it's funny in that, you know, you went all the way across the country to try to get away from these sort of blue-collar roots in some ways, at least the town. And then you proceeded to become known as a novelist writing about those roots.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny the way we kind of come back to our beginnings.
Well, you can run, but you can't hide, right? and that's what I discovered. I was kind of a slow learner about it. I had assumed that as a result of entering my own kind of personal private witness protection program, that the disguise would be successful. And if I could learn to act the way other people acted at the university, pursuing the life of the mind, a life of books, a life of ideas, that I could leave that stuff behind. And I wanted to be a writer.
You knew that from the beginning?
Well, not from the beginning, but I was almost finished with a PhD program in literature before I started to write at all. But still, once the bug bit me, I was a goner. You know, the virus spread really quickly through my system. But the kind of writer that I wanted to be was, number one, really serious, because I wanted to be taken seriously. Not as a small town boy of limited resources. I wanted to be an urban novelist. I wanted to write about crime. I wanted to write about dames. I wanted to be Raymond Chandler was what I wanted to be. And of course, those were all the things I didn't know anything about. And my first novel, I had the great good fortune to have a mentor, a writing mentor, who looked at my first novel and told me the bad news that I already knew. I mean, he didn't have to tell me that this was not a good book that I had written. And then he told me something that I was ready to hear, that the book sucked.
Yeah.
What I was not ready to hear was what he considered to be the book's silver lining, which was that there was about 40 pages of backstory that I had put in this book almost as filler. When the protagonist was a younger woman, and I had set it in a fictional town called Mohawk, and it was a mill town in upstate New York, and my mentor, this man who had taken the time to read my book and read it right straight through to its wretched end, said to me, he said, "Well, the good news is there's this 40 pages of backstory. Boy," he said, "you really know those people, and you know that place. Why don't you set the whole thing there?
Write what you know."
Yeah, and I hated him for about a month because it meant my disguise had failed. I mean, he looked right at the new invented better me, and through the words on the page looked right into who I was and saw who I was when I couldn't see it. So how can you not hate somebody like that, right? Until about a month later, when you realize how much you love him.
It's such a gift. Yeah. you on the subject of not being taken seriously, yeah. You know, you describe yourself as a comic writer. What do you think about that? Why do we think? Well, first off, let me back up. What do you mean by comic writer? When you think of yourself as a comic writer, I mean, do you mean, you know, haha funny, or what do you mean by
No. It has less to do with haha, and it has less to do with jokes than it has to do with, I think, comic in the sense of Shakespearean comedy. That is number one. I think of being fairly optimistic. And I am a cautiously optimistic human being, I think, and I always have been. But Shakespearean comedy is not only funny, but its laughs are rooted in character and in misapprehension about who we are. Right? That's what mm-hmm. happens in a Shakespearean comedy. People to pretend to be other than what they are and who they are. And at the end, there is usually an unmasking and a wedding. A marriage, you know, and society comes back together, and our inherent foolishness is resolved, and we all become kind of adults. Right. And that's my view. That's my view of comedy here, and it's the kind of comedy that I write.
Yeah. There are lessons. Yeah. I mean, do you feel like in our conversation about literature, not just literature, but all kinds of art, that if it's trying to be comedic, it's dismissed as unserious?
It can be, but it's also partly our own fault, in the sense that it seems to me that part of what the comic writer or the comic actor does is to make it look easy. Mm. And if you succeed in making it look easy, then you're never going to get an enormous amount of credit, or you're seldom going to get an enormous amount of credit, right? How many Oscars did Cary Grant win?
All right.
Right? The iconic actor of his generation, probably, so if you make it look easy, if it doesn't look like it's a heavy lift, then you know, maybe you're not going to be taking as seriously as someone who you can feel every muscle in his or her body just straining to make this lift. And that's not what we're about. We're that's part of the magic of comic writing, I think.
But you also talk about not taking yourself too seriously in the course of your early career.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that was an advantage? And if so, why?
I do. It's not a mistake that two of my novels, and probably two of my better known novels, contain the word fool in the title. And I allow my characters to do all manner of truly foolish things in my novels, but I never have them doing anything that I can't imagine myself doing in my own most foolish moments, of which there are many on any given day. So yeah, not taking yourself too seriously was something else I had to learn. But once I learned it, it was the kind of thing you don't forget, and that you remind yourself of every day when you sit down in front of a blank piece of paper, is that I'm not here really to dispense wisdom so much as foolishness.
And you're an educator as well as a writer. Speaking of things you learn, can writing be taught?
Absolutely. Well, let me back up a little bit and say that about 90% of writing can be taught. Mm. All the skills, the stuff at the skill level and the craft level, can be taught. My grandfather, who we were talking about earlier, was a glove cutter, and he belonged to a guild. And he learned from men who would who knew how to do it. And they put, essentially, like a piano teacher will put his or her hands over the student's hands, right? It's hands on, isn't it? and so someone who knows how to use the tool shows you how to handle the tool, how to use it, and so all of those things, all of the craft things, can be taught. Art, on the other hand, once you've learned how to use your tools, for most of us, there's something else that we have to deal with. Part of it is just self-knowledge. Who are you? What do you love? Who do you love? And those for most of us are the things that come last. You can learn to use your tools early, but an awful lot of people learn to use their tools exquisitely. Mm. without somehow in the end finding necessarily a voice or even sometimes a subject matter.
You also write about, or have talked about the process of having learned these tools, having built these skills, and then kind of going through them in a rote way, losing the ability to go back to being a beginner, and the creativity that comes from that.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I normally when I write a novel and it's published, I'm kind of through with it. But sometimes I will go back, especially if I've been asked maybe to write a draft of a screenplay based on one of my books. And I think probably maybe 10 or 12 years after my second novel, The Risk Pool, came out, somebody optioned it and asked me to write a draft of the screenplay. And of course, in order to do that, I had to go back and reread the book. And since then, I had published probably 3 or 4 other novels. And I remember going back through it and wishing that I could give it another edit and publish it in a newly revised version, because I had grown enough as an author. I possessed certain skills then that I didn't possess back when I was writing the original book. And I thought to myself as I was rereading it and making little notes about it, boy, I would write this book completely differently now. But I'm also quite certain that I would have ruined it completely, because that book needed to be written by someone my age with those experiences.
We have to wrap up. Thanks so much for joining me today, Richard.
Oh, Kai, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Richard Russo about his new book, The Destiny Thief. Tonight at 7:30, Richard will be in conversation with Eddie Joyce and signing books at Books Are Magic. That's at 225 Smith Street in Brooklyn.